I'm turning for our starting point to Paul's letter to the Colossians, chapter 3 and verse 21. Colossians, chapter 3, verse 21. Fathers, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged. And the parallel passage also in Ephesians, chapter 6 and verse 4. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And our title is Paul's Counsel to Parents, but we'll be looking at a number of scriptures. And this evening, it's just a talk about parenting. And the policy of parents towards the rearing of children. And it's very seldom that we do this, but we'll be looking at some general principles and turning to the scriptures, and we start here. Ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. And there's been some discussion down the years on why the apostle singles out the fathers. And the first answer, of course, is that it's the father's prime responsibility to care for the whole family and the children. But there's also quite a body of opinion that sees here just an indication that fathers are likely also to be the first to fall down on the job. Particularly in ancient culture, with all the physical work to be done of the smallholding, the farm, the trade, whatever the father followed, and with the, in those far-off days, the mothers being at home, perhaps it was the exhausted and distracted father who was the first to neglect responsibilities of family and parenting. And maybe that's hinted at, that it should be something which really is addressed to both parents, is particularly addressed to fathers. Ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. I wonder if that's possibly true today, that a mother's heart focuses more on the children, and it is the father who will be more likely to be tempted to neglect of the high policy of responsibility for children. Ye fathers. These are interesting terms. Bring up the children, bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And that's a phrase which we use a great deal. Nurture means to train. Admonition is the words you speak. That's the distinction between the two things. Nurture is what you do, the various channels you adopt to try to guide children into, the structure you place around them. All that is nurture, the training of children, the opportunities you give them, the restrictions you find it necessary to protect them with, and so on. It's all nurture, training, and admonition is what you say. Now, tonight we won't really be focusing on the most important thing of all, which is the spiritual instruction of children, but more the moral, ethical, and social instruction of children, because that's of vital importance at all times also. And I want to begin by talking then about frustrating of children. Ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath or anger or frustration or resentment or indignation, because all those things forfeit the vital authority which a parent has for children if the parent comes into contempt. So provoke not your children to wrath. Well, how are you going to do that? How can you provoke your children to wrath? Fathers first, but mothers also. Well, let me put first the obvious way by providing a very poor example. And if there's quarrelling between parents, or there are exhibitions of temper, or there is meanness, or there is unfairness, and or there is impatience, all these things will unreasonably, they're unreasonable, and they will bring a child to frustration. Temper is very much a learned thing in families. Children with bad tempers very often have parents with bad tempers. Children get used to fights and squabbles and meanness and hostility at home, on the outside, but on the inside, the intense sense of justice of a child will find one parent or the other responsible. And so that parent will be greatly undermined for the future, for training, for friendship, for guidance, for discipline. So that's the first and obvious way in which a child is frustrated or indignant or disturbed, and that is the bad example of the parents, but also obviously by indifference. And I think it's quite common. I don't know about among Christians, but it certainly is common in the world that there is indifference for children. Parents want to be proud of their children at times, but much of the time they ignore them, let them get on with it, pay no attention to what's happening in their lives or at home. Sometimes there's a reason for it. The whole family is busy. Parents working, because most parents have to work these days to be able to survive. And so the household is busy and stressed, and children can be a nuisance. And neglect and indifference to them leads to the anger and frustration of the child. But so does the opposite. And I've seen this. Parents who give too much interest to their children. I remember, and I'm thinking of things that I've observed years and years ago, decades ago, not any people known among us, but I've known a mother who, she took far too much interest in her children, and everything they did, if it was a teenager going out to play a football match, the mother had to learn almost about it, every kick when the boy got home, and live it with him, and share every triumph and weep at every tragedy. We just try to live his life for him. And sometimes parents do that. They go over the top. And some parents give much too much attention, and they inhibit and frustrate children. And they're almost a nuisance to their children. That's very sad when that happens. They may mean well. I remember another lady, I'm sorry the examples are both ladies in this case, but I remember another lady who, every time her teenage daughter had a kind of minor crush on someone, or a passing courtship or something like that, everybody had to know about it. The mother would tell everybody. And the child was so frustrated by this that nothing was private. Nothing could be done without the mother sharing it and talking about the daughter and talking about her situation and so on. Immensely aggravating and upsetting to children. So too much intrusion, especially as young people are growing, can be dangerous also. And that, I think that's a tendency these days, because these days, well, culture has changed, and an awful lot is done for children. A tremendous amount is organised. Many will remember Brother John Bull, who was our missionary in various African countries for years, a wartime fighter pilot, and after the war he was called to missionary service, and with his wife he served in a number of places. But he came from these parts, and he lived not very far from here. And he would tell us how when he was a boy, his mother would give him a halfpenny, literally half a penny, which was what you had to pay for as a child before the war for go anywhere underground ticket, and send him off with a pack of sandwiches, and he'd go as far as he possibly could, I think out to Gants Hill on the east, where in those days the houses ended and the countryside began. And maybe with a friend, maybe by himself, would wander around the whole day in the countryside and then come back. And his mother, well, she could get on with her work. She'd send him off at about 8 in the morning on a Saturday when there was no school, and he'd be back by 6 for tea. You couldn't imagine doing that with a child today. Nobody would dare do that because society now is so dangerous and there are so many potential problems. So we've swung to the opposite extreme. Things have changed. Even in 50 years, I remember when my wife and I first came to the tabernacle, if you had a baby or an infant and you went to a store, there outside the store would be perhaps 2 or 3 dozen, maybe as many as 30 prams with babies in them and all the parents shopping in the store. You couldn't imagine people doing that today. Society is so dangerous by comparison. I'm only mentioning these examples because now so much is done for children. Even when our children were small, the first church manse we lived in was down in Dunwich when we came here to the tabernacle. And it was very nice because it backed onto a huge sports field which belonged to the University of the South Bank, but 40, 50 years ago they scarcely used it. And our children would disappear out of the back garden into that field, and they knew where the secret gap was between the railings, hidden by hedging, into the next sports field and over into Bel Air Park, which you probably know. And they'd be out for ages. Today you'd put us in prison for allowing that. Society has radically changed. But you have to be careful, because you can do too much for children and leave nothing to their imagination and their liberty and their own responsibility. And you do have to be so careful not to do too much. Well, obviously, a fourth subheading, criticism and discouragement, is very frustrating to the young growing up. Pouring cold water on dreams. Well, they may be fanciful, but you don't crush things because they're youthful. And then another point to make is the necessity of punishment. Now, that's an ugly word these days. Says Solomon in Proverbs, foolishness, that's depravity, is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. Now, these days, most Christians, I think, would tend to interpret the rod of correction in a figurative way. And that's a perfectly legitimate thing to do, and to think in terms of admonition and restrictions and deprivations or withholding of benefits or pleasures. And actually there's great wisdom in choosing those kind of alternatives, because there's never any suspicion in the mind of the one punished that the punishment is just vindictive, or there's far less of a readiness to suspect that, which with physical punishment is an ever-present temptation that Dad is doing this out of temper, or this is he's doing it just because he's nasty, and so on. So although it's perfectly legitimate to use with restraint and care corporal punishment by the standards of the Bible, there is great wisdom in the alternatives which Christian parents tend to lean to today. Of course, I'm an old man, so I grew up in a different atmosphere. Every school I ever went to as a child, there was regular caning every day of the week. But now that's all in the past, and I've every respect for exploring the non-corporal way of correcting the child. But all punishments must be carefully in accordance with the seriousness of the offence. I've often mentioned this, but I was very taken by reading in the biography of Horatio Spooner, a great Scottish preacher of the 19th century, known today by his very beautiful hymns. Well, when Horatio Spooner was a child, he'd been scrumping, taking apples from the neighbour's garden. And he'd evidently been spotted. And he overheard a conversation between the neighbour and his father. And the neighbour was saying to his father how outrageous the boy's behaviour was, and he should be thrashed for such an offence. And as Spooner crouched trembling somewhere behind a hedge, he heard his father say to the neighbour, "Yes, but if I thrashed the boy for that, what would I do if he told me a lie?" And that's really a very instructive event, because punishments must fit the crime, and there mustn't just be the same punishment or deprivation or whatever meted out for minor as well as major things. It's great care. And don't forget, every child has a far, far greater sense of justice than the parent. Our memories go way back. You see that a sibling was given a much lesser punishment for the same offence. So do take care about punishments. I'd like to give a second heading, and it seems rather obvious, but child rearing is preparing for adult life. This isn't a matter of simply producing a happy household now. Why am I disciplining a child? Because I want this household to be tranquil and well-behaved and happy now. That's not the main objective. The main objective of child rearing is to prepare the child for adult life. So much depends upon the parental policy in this. When a child is an adult, as you well know, the child is going to have to face up to a vast number of systems imposed upon him or her and restricting him. And some of his ambitions will be denied, and his aspirations will often be frustrated and unachievable, and there'll be restrictions put on him or her, and he or she will be subject to unfairness and great disappointment. And the question is this: are you training up a child now who will be able to stand up to all that adult life will throw at him or her? Now, if we're the kind of parents who allow the children to run freely everywhere, there are no no-go areas, there are no restricted or private places, there is nothing that a child can't do or get into. I remember many, many years ago, no one will remember this, We had even a deacon whose children were almost out of control. And you'd see them rushing in and out of the deacon's vestry and rushing around the vast table that was in there and so on. Nothing was sacred. Not that I'm suggesting the deacon's vestry is sacred, but nothing was to be respected. Nothing was special. Nothing was out of bounds. Those youngsters grew up to be very troublesome young people. And it all started in childhood because there were no restrictions, no limitations, nothing to curb. These things are strengthening. They're not always deprivations. They're a great help. Your child will one day be a very small unit in society and subject to all these problems. Your child is very unlikely to be a monarch or an emperor. If your child makes it to prime minister, it'll only be for a time. And the day will come when he or she will be turfed out of office and discover there isn't a car or a chauffeur to take him or her home, and is back to being an ordinary citizen and under all the same pressures. Well, that's obvious. We're training children for the future, not just for a calm household now. And do we have training schemes? One I remember, I knew a man very well, it was a great help to me, who was a very wealthy farmer in Yorkshire. And he was a multi-millionaire and a great supporter of Christian causes. But if you went to see him, you discovered his boys had something like, I don't remember the figures, 10 piglets each and a pen. And they were to keep them, feed them from their pocket money, look after them, keep an account, put them up for sale, make a profit. They were only 9 or 10, these boys, and they were already being trained in a simple way, responsibility. And the father knew these youngsters would inherit various privileges and responsibilities, and he was starting early. Well, you may not want to keep piglets in the back garden or anything quite like that, but you have any economic schemes? Anything children can do where they have to completely look after their own affairs with some jurisdiction, simple training and preparation. All this comes in to child rearing. I remember a minister at a fraternal saying many years ago that one of the big responsibilities that parents have, which few rise to, is to teach their children general knowledge. In the old days, I don't know about now, schools used to be pretty good at teaching general knowledge at junior level. And then after that, you went into the secondary education scheme and you were taking set subjects. General knowledge was dead and finished. And whether children became scientists or whether they went into arts and humanities or whatever, their general knowledge was generally very, very poor. And one of the great opportunities for Christian parents is to interest the children and help them and advance their general knowledge. And that gives opportunities for various things in home life and various schemes and books and things like that. And you can always be interesting to your children. And I think there's much in that. Although it's out of turn, it's a great shame when you come across parents who think their children are brilliant. They may be right, though I doubt it, but if they are, whether they are or not, it's very dangerous to the children. It is impossible to think your children are brilliant without the children getting wind of it. And they think they're brilliant. And that's the worst training a child can have. So, and also it's dangerous, because children change position. Some children are very dull when they're young, and they do get quite clever when they're adults. And for others, it's the other way round. Anybody who knows me will be surprised to hear me say this, but when I was a child, I used to do very well in junior level and all that sort of thing in arithmetic. I can scarcely believe it myself now, but I used to be regarded as exceptional and gifted. But somehow, as I went through teenage, I lost it. I lost my way. And nowadays, with numbers, I think I must be a little bit dyslexic, because my numerical skills are so poor. So be careful with children. Things change. A child may have a bright spot for a time, and then things level out. I know it's not always the case. Some show their genius from a very early age, but don't indulge in parental pride as though your children are brilliant and clever, because it communicates. Let's look at some texts. Go back to 1 Samuel, if you will, and chapter 2, and a very sad episode here in connection with Eli. 1 Samuel, chapter 2, and verse 12. Now, the sons of Eli were sons of Belial, children of the devil. They knew not the Lord. And then the following verses describe one aspect of their wickedness. It doesn't at first sight sound the most serious. Something much more serious is mentioned later. But it was serious because it abused the offerings of the Lord. They stole, on threat of violence, meat from the sacrificial offerings. Then if you go down to verse 17, you read, "Wherefore the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for men abhorred the offering of the Lord. Not only were they sinning against the Lord's sacred worship system, but they brought the sacrifices into disrepute in the eyes of the children of Israel." And then in verse 22 we read this, "Now Eli was very old, and heard all that his sons did unto all Israel, and how they lay with the women that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And he said unto them, Why do ye such things? For I hear of your evil dealings by all this people. Nay, my sons, for it is no good report that I hear. This is so tame. Ye make the Lord's people to transgress. If one man sin against another, the judge shall judge him. But if a man sin against the Lord, who shall entreat for him? He didn't do anything. He didn't fire them, stand them down, have them punished. Notwithstanding, it's not surprising, they hearken not unto the voice of their father, because the Lord would slay them for this." What a tragic thing that Eli, for all his faithfulness, was so poor towards his children. It must have started from a very early age, his complete slackness and indifference. I go to Proverbs, a few texts from the book of Proverbs, and our time will be out in no time. Proverbs 19 and verse 18. Here it is. Chasten thy son while there is hope, and let not thy soul spare for his crying. While there is hope, this is the word of God. While there is hope, you haven't got all the time in the world. You lose the vital early years to correct, to caution, then it's too late. The teenager won't receive it if it suddenly begins out of the blue. That's an inspired warning for us. And then on to Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 15. Well, we quoted this, foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. That's not your pastor, that's the word of God. That wisely carried out correction is effective. And what's more, totally effective. Foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction, however you interpret that and apply that, shall drive it far from him. That's a very valuable promise. And then the next chapter, Proverbs 23, verse 13. Withhold not correction from the child, for if thou beatest him with the rod, he shall not die. Thou shalt beat him with the rod and shalt deliver his soul from hell. Once again, it may be much preferable to apply a figurative rod, but you may deliver his soul from hell. His or her openness to the gospel may be lost if he or she goes uncorrected, unpunished, and thoroughly spoiled, and becomes wanton. And then Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 15. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself bringeth his mother to shame. Wisdom. This is a very precious proverb, really. In punishment, a child must see the point. That's another argument very often in favour of non-physical corrective measures. It may be much easier to get the point across to the child and the reason for the deprivation or the punishment. And while that reason may not be accepted immediately, well, it's important the child understands, because wisdom, the education of the child, is the ultimate objective. A child must see the point. I would have gone to Hebrews 12, but time doesn't permit, to look at the passage there on the chastening of the Lord, and how when the Lord punishes his people, adult people, he does so in stages, by degrees. The gentler warning first, and the gentler punishment, and then the more painful one follows if that's ignored. And in the care of children, it should be the same. There should be a development, a gradation of these things. I'd like to say just a word or two before we come to conclusion about duties for children. And this is particularly hard in days when there's an awful lot of homework and so on for children. But duties for children are very important. The Apostle Paul in Galatians 4:1 says, "Now I say that the heir, as long as he is a child, differeth nothing..." Well, from servants. But as the apostle points out, we're all under governors and tutors. But the important point is this, And although the apostle has a spiritual application, he obviously is inspired to approve of the arrangement that for a child is not more important than a servant, while the child is a child. Now, it has been wisely said, and it's not fair to generalize, but it's been wisely said that if royals had known this scripture and observed it, they would have had much better outcomes for many of their children. But so often among royals, the child is much more important than the servant, and isn't allowed to forget it. And that's terrible for the child. The child is no more important than a servant. And that brings us to duties for children. In the old days, parents were expected to give children duties, whether it was table laying or bed making, whole range of achievable and simple things. When my wife and I first came to the tabernacle, the Spurgeon's orphanage was still open down in Sittingbourne in Kent. It had been along the road here at Stockwell, but during the war, just before the war, it was moved out into the clear of the air raids to Sittingbourne in Kent. And every couple of years, an outing of tabernacle youngsters would be taken to the orphanage as a visit, to visit the grounds, visit the orphanage. Now, in those days, in the 70s, we had some pretty rough and tumble children round here, I can tell you. But a large party would be taken on this Sunday school outing to the Spurgeon's orphanage at Sittingbourne. At one point, they would be conducted round the dormitories, and they would see all the orphanage children's beds, with the blankets all boxed up in perfect military style, everything neat and tidy, and one of the staff saying, well, this is what the children have to do first thing in the morning. And our Elephant and Castle children would just stand and gape in astonishment and in amazement. Many of them had never made a bed in their lives. Everything was done for many of them. And here they saw all the duties and so on that fell to the orphanage children. What about our households, friends? Are there duties? I remember visiting a man again. I'm not in the habit of visiting millionaires, but this man was a millionaire in the United States. And I drove up the drive of his house, his boys, and they were only 8, 9, 10, were all clearing, well, seemed to me like tons of autumn leaves from the drives. And yes, this man had money, but his children were required to sweep up, do all kinds of things. What about our well-fed middle-class children? Do we assign duties and so on? 1 Peter 3:8, wonderful text. Love us, brethren, be pitiful, be courteous. I'm coming to conclusion, friends. Manners. This isn't cultural. Manners. Why, if there weren't such things as good manners, we Christians would have to invent them. They are so wonderful for helping train children, growing children. Good manners, good table manners, especially when there are guests, make a child self-conscious in the right sense, in the best sense, aware how his or her behavior, however young, affects other people. Teaches the children to notice the needs of others. For children to learn good manners and to know when to hold back, when to yield to others, when to notice the needs of others, when to offer to pass things, when to be silent and to respect elders or visitors, when to keep their place at the table instead of leaping down and rushing off because it's not good manners. These things are wonderful for the training of children and so helpful to them. And the child is so much stronger, so much more considerate as an adult, so much kinder, so much more capable. These things are tremendous, friends. Well, I've just been talking practical matters, ethical, social matters. But all of us with children need a considered approach and much prayer and much kindness. And may the Lord richly bless every parent among us.